The following is an evening darshan given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on December 20th, 1982 in New Orleans, Louisiana. The class is about the teachings of Queen Kunti, chapter 22.
Our kingdom is now being marked by the impressions of your feet, and therefore it appears beautiful. But when you leave, it will no longer be so. This is a prayer by Queen Kunti. In this regard, Prabhupada says, there are certain particular marks on the feet of the Lord which distinguish the Lord from others. The marks of a flake, thunderbolt, an instrument to drive an elephant, and also an umbrella, lotus, disc, etc. are on the bottom of the Lord's feet. These marks are impressed upon the soft dust of the land where the Lord traverses. The land of Hastinapur was thus marked while Lord Sri Krishna was there with the Pandavas. And the kingdom of the Pandavas thus flourished by such auspicious signs. Kunti Devi points out these distinguished features and is afraid of ill luck in the absence of the Lord. In the Chanakya Sloka, the instructions of the great moralist Chanakya Pandit, there is this very nice verse. Prithivi Bhushanam Raja Narinam Bhushanam Pati Sarvari Bhushanam Chandro Vidya Sarvasya Bhushanam. Everything looks beautiful when one is intimately related with it. The sky, for example, becomes beautiful in relationship with the moon. The sky is always present, but on the full moon night when the moon and the stars shine brilliantly, it looks very nice. Similarly, the state looks very well if there is a good government with a good king or president. Then everyone is happy and everything goes on well. Also, although girls are naturally beautiful, a girl looks especially beautiful when she has a husband. Vidya Sarvasya Bhushanam. But if a person, however ugly, is a learned scholar, that is his beauty. Similarly, everything will look beautiful when Krishna is present. Therefore, Kunti Devi thinks, as long as Krishna is with us, everything in our kingdom, in our capital, Hastinapur, is beautiful. But when Krishna is absent, our kingdom will not be beautiful. She says, Krishna, you are now walking in our kingdom, and the impressions of your footprints are making everything beautiful. There is sufficient water and fruit and everything looks beautiful. But when you leave us, it will not look beautiful. Unquote. It is not that this applied only when Krishna was present and Queen Kunti was speaking. Rather, the truth is always the same. Despite the advancement of our civilization, if we cannot bring Krishna and Krishna consciousness into the center of everything, our civilization will never become beautiful. Those who have joined the Krishna consciousness movement were beautiful before they joined, but now that they have become Krishna conscious, they look especially beautiful. Therefore, the newspapers often describe the devotees as bright-faced. Their countrymen remark how joyful and beautiful these boys and girls have become. At the present time in America, many of the younger generation are confused and hopeless, and therefore they appear morose and black-faced. Why? Because they are missing the point. They have no aim in life. But the devotees, the Krishnites, look very beautiful because of the presence of Krishna. Therefore, what was a fact 5,000 years ago during the time of the Pandavas is still a fact now. With Krishna in the center, everything becomes beautiful, and Krishna can become the center at any time. Krishna is always present, and we simply have to invite Him. My Lord, please come and be in the center. That's all. To give the same example I had given before, zero has no value. But if we bring the number one and place it by the side of zero, the zero becomes 10. So one need not stop whatever one is doing. We never say, stop everything material. One simply has to add Krishna. Of course, if we have to give up anything which is against Krishna consciousness, it is not that because we do not stop material duties, we should not stop meat eating. We must stop it, for this is contrary to advancement in Krishna consciousness. One cannot commit sinful activities and at the same time advance in Krishna consciousness. But Krishna says, Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo Moksha Yishami, surrender unto me and I shall rescue you by giving you liberation from all kinds of sinful karmic reactions. Every one of us, life after life, is knowingly or unknowingly committing sinful activities. I may knowingly kill an animal, and that is certainly sinful, but even if I do it unknowingly, it is also sinful. While walking on the street, we unknowingly kill so many ants. And in the course of our other ordinary dealings, while cooking, while taking water, while using a mortar and pestle to crush spices, we kill so many living beings. Unless we remain Krishna conscious, we are liable to be punished for all these unknowingly committed sinful acts. If a child unknowingly touches fire, does it mean that the fire will excuse the child and not burn it? No. Nature's law is so strict, so stringent that there is no excuse, no question of an excuse. Even in ordinary law, ignorance is no excuse. If we go to court and say, I did not know that this action was criminal, this plea does not mean that we shall be excused. Similarly, ignorance is no excuse for transgressing nature's laws. Therefore, if we actually want to be free from the reactions of sinful life, we must be Krishna conscious, for then Krishna will free us from all sinful karmic reactions. It is therefore recommended, Kirtaniya Sada Hari. One should always chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We should always keep Krishna within our minds, for Krishna is like the sun. This is the motto of our Back to Godhead magazine. Krishna Surya Sama Maya Hoya Andhakar Yaha Krishna Taha Nahi Mayar Odhikar. Krishna is just like the brilliant sun, and Maya, ignorance, is just like darkness. When the sun is present, there cannot be darkness. So if we keep ourselves in Krishna consciousness always, we cannot be influenced by the darkness of ignorance. Rather, we shall always walk very freely in the bright sunshine of Krishna. Queen Kunti Devi therefore prays that Krishna consciousness, that Krishna continue to be present with her and the Pandavas. We simply have to apply our mind and senses in Krishna consciousness as done by Maharaj Ambarish. Savai mana Krishna padar avindayor vachansi vaikuntha gunanuvarnane. From the Bhagavatam 9.4.18. First, we must fix our minds on the lotus feet of Krishna, for the mind is the center of all sensory activities. If the mind were absent, in spite of having eyes, we could not see. And in spite of having ears, we could not hear. Therefore, the mind is considered the 11th sense. There are 10 senses, 5 working senses and 5 knowledge acquiring senses. And the center of the senses is the mind. The Bhagavad Gita says, Indriyani paryanyahur indriyebhya parangmana manasastu parabuddhir yo buddhe paratastusa. In this verse, Krishna explains that although we consider the senses to be very prominent, beyond the senses is something superior, the mind. Beyond the mind is the intelligence, and beyond the intelligence is the soul. How can we appreciate the existence of the soul if we cannot understand even the psychological movements of the mind? Beyond the mind is the intelligence, and by speculation one can at the utmost approach the intellectual platform. But to understand soul and God, one must go beyond the intellectual platform. It is possible to understand everything, but we must gain understanding through the right channel. Therefore, the Vedic injunction is Tat vigyanartham sagurum eva vigachet samit pani srotriyam brahmanishtam. If one is actually serious about understanding supernatural, transcendental subject matters, one must approach a bona fide spiritual master. From the Mundaka Upanishad, first part, second chapter, 12th verse of the Vedic literatures. Thus end the Prabhupada's commentary on the teachings of Queen Kunti, the beauty in Krishna's presence, the 22nd chapter. So here Queen Kunti described how Krishna's lotus feet are special, that they contain particular marks which ordinary people do not have on their lotus feet. Flag, thunderbolt, an instrument, gold, also an umbrella, lotus, disc, and so many other marks. So when Krishna would walk on the ground, you look at his footprint, you would see all these marks. And that's how there was once a devotee called Akrur, and he was driving his chariot to the land of Krishna. And as he was driving, he looked on the ground, and he saw the footprint of Krishna, and he could see that it was Krishna's footprint because it had all the marks in it, in the sand, in the dust. It would leave, because he had walked barefoot, it would leave all those marks. And he looked down and saw the marks, saw that it was Krishna's footprint. And immediately he became overwhelmed with love for Krishna. And he became so ecstatic that while he was driving the chariot, he stopped the chariot and he fell on the ground and he started to roll in the dust where Krishna's footprints were. And he was crying, how wonderful, how wonderful, how wonderful to be here in Krishna's land. And he was celebrated as the greatest devotee for his spontaneous attraction to Krishna's lotus feet. You can see here how unusually attractive Krishna's lotus feet are. The goddess of fortune is always seen massaging the lotus feet of Krishna. And the great devotees, they are known as bumblebees because they say that Krishna's lotus feet are emitting some sweet honey-like nectar. And the devotees who are chanting his holy names and who are engaged in his devotional service, they are like bumblebees. They're going there and they're eating the honey which is at the lotus feet of Krishna. So, actually, there's also a story about how when Krishna was a bit older, at that time before the battlefield of Kurukshetra, he offered to his friend and to the cousin brother of his friend. Arjuna was his friend and Duryodhana was the opponent of Arjuna. He was cousin brother of Arjuna. He offered them that whoever he would see first, he would give them the choice that they were going to fight. And Krishna said that either I will fight or my army. You can have either me or my army. So Krishna was taking rest, and then Arjuna came first to Krishna's room, and he thought, let me sit by the feet of Krishna. Let me sit there. He took a humble position. And Duryodhana came in, he thought that I'm not going to sit by the feet of anybody, I'll sit over there by his head. So then I'll be by his head, he'll see me first. So Krishna was laying down on his back. And when Krishna opened his eyes, naturally, he was looking down to his feet. So then he saw Arjuna first. He said, oh, Arjuna, you've come. How are you? And then he looks at, oh, Duryodhana, you are also here. So then, this way, Arjuna was seen first. He says, well, you get the first choice. Who do you want? Do you want me to be on your side, or do you want my army? So Arjuna thought, he said, what's the use of the army without Krishna? If we have Krishna, we have everything. So he said, I want you. So Krishna says, well, you can have me, but I won't fight. I won't lift any arms. That's all right. If I have you, that's all I need. So then Duryodhana thought, well, what's the use of just having Krishna? He's not even going to fight. Because he was a demon. He was a non-devotee. He had no faith in Krishna, divine power or anything. So he was just materialist. So he thought that, could I have some water? This is much better. I'll take his army. Krishna's not even going to fight. So everybody was happy. So I just pointing out that Arjuna actually, by getting Krishna, he was successful and he won the whole battle of Kurukshetra. Not only that, but also he was elevated because the mood that he fought the battle was in a mood of service to Krishna. He didn't fight it for any other reason. That's, of course, the long discussion of the Bhagavad Gita. And the whole basis of having Krishna on his chariot was that he sat at the feet of Krishna. So devotees are recommended that when they approach Krishna, if they first meditate in a circular form, looking first at his feet, then going to his knees, then to his waist, then to his lotus chest, his neck, his smiling mouth, his eyes, lotus eyes, and then go back to the feet. So not as to be so forward as to just immediately look at his lotus face, but to first go up from the lotus feet and then approach the lotus face. Like that, everything in Krishna consciousness has got a system. There's so many systems that practically it's unlimited. Just like in playing the drum, although I'm not very good, and this is just a fiberglass drum. In India we have clay drums. But there are certain mantras that you learn. It's very tight. There's certain mantras for playing the drum. Each sound has got a certain spoken vibration called a bowl. So when you learn to play, you learn ki ta ta, ki ta ta, ki ta ta, ki ki ta ta, ki ta ta, ki ta ta, ki ta ta, ki ki ta ta. Each sound has, each beat has a specific sound. Then there's others, ki o ta ki ta di. And there are hundreds of mantras like that. Even while the drummer is playing, he's thinking of various mantras. Often you see four drummers playing in unison and they're saying outside the different mantras. Ki-ta-ta, ki-ta-ta, ta! And you can hear them in unison, and they're beating in the drums and playing. It's very beautiful to see. But actually what happens is that their consciousness becomes completely fixed. There's no other thought. They're playing one thing and their mind also is on the playing. They're meditating on that particular vibration. And this way it actually is a meditation. If one is able to do their service for Krishna, do some activity for Krishna with that type of concentration, very careful that it's done perfectly for Krishna, even though it may appear externally, oh, he's doing sewing or cooking or some driving a car, whatever it may be, that type of concentration, if one is fixed to do it perfectly for Krishna, then it's considered that that devotional service is a perfect meditation. A more perfect meditation than, say, just sitting down and meditating in Hatha Yoga, because in Hatha Yoga one may be sitting and meditating for some time, but then as soon as one stops, the meditation is broken. Well, that active meditation can go on through all the activities. And moreover, Hatha Yoga, at that moment, you're stopping activities. And by stopping activities, you're not creating any new karmas. But if you're not actually getting rid of the old karmas at a very appreciable rate. But while serving Krishna, as we mentioned here, that he promises, sarva dharma parityaja mamayakam sarangbaja ahantam sarva papi bhyo mukheshami masucha, that he protects one from all of the sinful reactions, from all of the bad karmic reactions which we have accumulated by killing other living entities, by creating pain for other living entities, which we cannot avoid doing. Even unknowingly we're doing it. We're walking on the street, we're crushing ants. And of course, knowingly, You know, if we're eating meat and things, then naturally we're also killing so many living entities when it may not be necessary. So as a result, we start to accumulate so many karmas. Bernard Shaw is a contemporary writer, recent writer. He's not like very ancient, is it?
It's no, 1900s.
He wrote that how can people expect the evils of war or something like that to end when they're killing the animals unnecessarily? You know, I mean, he wrote it in a very, he's a great writer. I can't remember the, I didn't memorize the quote, but anyway, something like to that effect, that because we're killing the blood of the, he wrote it in a, you know, very flowery way, the blood of the animals is on our hand, they have a right to live and we're killing them, so how do we expect that we're going to avoid the bloodshed of wars? So even, you know, the practically modern moralist also can understand that for every action there's a reaction. But how to get out of these reactions, that is a great secret of transcendental realization. That to get out of these reactions, one has to take some specific recourse. So Krishna has offered that if someone surrenders to him, if someone takes shelter of him, if someone engages in his service, then he protects that person. All the activity done for Krishna, there's no reaction for that. But in material life, everything we do for ourselves, good or bad, there's a reaction. And we have to take the responsibility for the reaction when it comes. It may come now, it may come up next birth, it may come 10 births. We may suddenly walk out in the street and suffer, Krishna forbid, some kind of accident. That may be the reaction of something we did 5 births in the past, 10 births in the past. We can't say that when what karma is coming on. We may walk out and someone may hand us $1 million. That may also be our karma from previous births. No one can say what the future holds. But it's more people that are having accidents and are getting handed $1 million in general. But somehow or another, whatever happens, because right now this age is called Kali Yuga, where the people's fortune is very bad. Because people are doing so many bad type of karmic activities, therefore they're getting so many painful. Sinful means what? Sinful reaction means reactions which cause us pain. Now, there may be so many Christian connotations to sinful, but in a purely scientific terminology, sinful reaction means the reaction which is going to cause us some mental or physical pain. Because of some pain that somehow or another, directly or indirectly, we have caused unto others. Colonel Sanders has caused a lot of living entities pain. He's going to have to suffer pain himself. Anyone who causes his own body unnecessarily pain even, say one is torturing one's own body, that also is a type of sinful activity, it's a type of karma produced from that, which again puts one into difficulty. On the other hand, you are uplifting people, or you're helping people, say materially you do some welfare work for others. You build a well that people can drink water out of. You build, put trees by the side of the road, people get shade. Or say someone gives a donation to some poor person. Well, whatever you give it a donation, you get back the same amount at least. And if the person, if a donation is given to some more spiritual person, then you get 10 times, 100 times, million times, unlimited times, depending on the level of advancement of that person. Because the more advanced he is, the more welfare work that he is doing for countless living entities, and the higher level of welfare work he's doing in terms of spiritual welfare giving. So there's a lot of dangers to material good work. Say that you give a donation to a poor man. According to the law of karma, you are therefore the benefactor of the poor man. That poor man becomes indebted to you. To repay that debt, you may have to take birth as the son or daughter of that poor man in a future life. Because the parent is always serving the children. And by serving the children, naturally the children become indebted to the parent. So some of the children are
children because in previous life they had been benefactor. Now they become children so that person can repay the debt by raising them as children. So that's why it's recommended not even to give charity without thinking. If one without considering proper time, place, person, just gives, say, to some bum, here, take $100 or take some $10, something like that. In the law of karma, that type of indiscriminate charity also binds one by karma to that person. So therefore, even charity is supposed to be given at proper time, proper place. Food is supposed to be done in a proper time, in a proper way. Everything has a different way of doing it where you're going to get a different reaction. If it's done in the mode of goodness, you're going to get a good reaction. If it's done in passion, it brings misery. And if it's done in ignorance, then it brings bondage. It brings further ignorance and madness, illusion, bewilderment. So Krishna consciousness takes, because the charity or the activities, the meditation is directed to Krishna, it takes one completely out of this whole material chain, ring of perpetual action and reaction. And by doing that, immediately one feels relief. Immediately one feels relief. Savai pung sangha paro dharmo yato bhakti radho kaja ahaitu kyapratiyata yatma su prasidati. As soon as one engages in devotional service, and immediately one feels satisfaction, feels completely fulfilled right to the core of the soul. So this is a basic Krishna consciousness movement. You read a little bit about the teachings of Queen Kunti, and I thought it was appropriate about Krishna's lotus feet. We were talking about feet before. Also, that was coincidental of Krishna's arrangement. So, actually, Krishna consciousness is the great science. It's for everyone. It's described as like a big rain cloud, or even like the sun. The sun is distributing very munificently its sunlight to everyone. You see, it's up to the individual how he wants to stay in the sunlight. If rain is showering down, the rain doesn't consider this is a grass, this is a street, this is a crop. The rain just comes down. But you can put up your umbrella. You can stay in your house, you can go out in the rain. Well, like that, Krishna's mercy is there, it's coming down. And it's up to each individual how much of Krishna's mercy they are able to monopolize, you can say, are able to accumulate. You see. The mercy is there for everyone. That nectar is there for everyone, but the capacity of an individual to take that mercy, that is the only difference. Some people are taking 24 hours a day the mercy of Krishna, and some people are taking it occasionally, and some people are avoiding it, like the plague. All different kinds of people. So those who are able to take it part-time, they're very fortunate, partially fortunate. Those who are able to take the mercy of Krishna more, then they're more fortunate. And those who are able to take Krishna's mercy completely, they're completely fortunate. And those who are able to give out that nectar of Krishna to others, that's also a great fortune. And that is a way of winning special favor with Krishna. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare.
I was going to ask you some other questions, but how come, I just saw you do something, how come you didn't put that cup to your mouth and you just said, maybe I shouldn't ask that sort of question. how come you got the glass and you didn't put it up to your lips and you just let it go through the air?
Aerated water.
Oh, okay. Well, you don't normally put your lip to it like that?
No, because the mouth is considered to be, generally little, if we touch our mouth, then we're supposed to wash our hands. Especially we're dealing with scriptures and everything. So because it's a little inconvenient to wash the hands all the time. So then, if you drink it without touching, then you have to wash.
Okay.
That's the basic reason. Also, water tastes better that way.
clear because you don't have the metal press or the material press to your mouth and get that flavor, huh?
That may be one of the reasons. Because you're not... The water is still also... Once you touch your lips to the water, then it's already touched also. So when you don't touch it, the water is still in its original state. So the first taste will taste like the last.
Then it would be like going outside when it's raining and opening your mouth and making water like that. Just do that. You know, I don't do it now. I wouldn't do it in this city. I don't do it in this city because all the air pollution around here.
And now you do that in America, you get acid rain. Prabhupada, sometimes he'd have a big ball and he would joke with the disciples. He'd take a piece of candy or something and take and throw it in his mouth without touching. And see, I did not touch. That's another disciple taking. You've touched. I have to wash your hand. You get up, wash your hand, then they try to take it. No, it's clean. And there's somebody without thinking they took it, and then they just touched. He's training us like that. Because what happened in the West, people, they touch their mouths, or they, you know, may get their hands dirty in different ways, and then they're not usually that conscious about cleanliness. Actually, in India, and even in Krishna, you find the devotees eat with their bare hands. But before they eat, they wash their hands. At least they're supposed to. And that generally they're supposed to keep their hands clean. Because we're always dealing with chanting beads, and with, especially once the beads are chanted on by the spiritual master, then you're supposed to be careful not to get the beads dirty and things like that. So, just to train the devotees in a different level of cleanliness, you know, like washing after eating. I mean, these aren't actually even American. I mean, I was always trained like that, even in my childhood. You know, what they used to say, you have to wash your hands before and after you eat, things like that. But that's also when people are dealing with spiritual paraphernalia, they have to be especially conscious of purity. There's certain guidelines. So, being living in India for 12 years, I learned how to eat and drink without touching. This simplified matters. Then I'd have to run to wash my hair. But it's not that, not very important. Mainly it's important to chant Hare Krishna.
Yeah, that's true, but I'm just saying it's interesting, though, you know.
Of course. What do you think, John?
I've enjoyed your company with us. I sort of feel part of the temple here because I visit so often. But I've enjoyed your teachings, and I would like to ask a couple of questions. I've been discussing with some people and acquaintances the trends that our American society is taking, such as our economics and such as just a general trend, say like things such as crime. You know, what would be your outlook for the near future concerning these things in America? I mean, do you foresee like a big conclusion?
You haven't seen. I think you haven't seen anything yet.
You think there's still a lot more to come? A heavy.
Unless people are turned around from this mad race after materialism, it can't help but get worse. Just like the government is asking the psychiatrist to explain why somebody would put cyanide in a Tylenol bottle. And they may say that, well, the person was a split paranoid, manic, depressive, massive, you know, give some, you know, definition in Latin terms or something, but ultimately it doesn't answer the real question. Is that because the whole society doesn't have any aim, no spiritual objective, so people get more and more frustrated in their material desires. The more you have, the more you want. Everyone knows it. So in India, at least they know that that's not good, that that's not the goal, that there's actually a higher purpose, which is beyond just the accumulating material objects, is actually to become spiritually advanced. Like someone was telling me that you know, they always feel obligated to do something just to try to make a success of their life, you know, like accumulate a certain amount of prestige or position just to satisfy the society, the family, the other people. But ultimately, just accumulating, if you have enough accumulation of material objects, you know, you have a big car, you have a big house, you have a stereo set, or you have a good job, or you have a little fame or money or something, but then you're a success, and you're all right, then everything is... But that's just like so superficial. That even the people that have that, just like in this recent interview with George Harrison, he said that when you already can have all the money, you don't even know what to do with it. You have everything. Then you know, you start to realize that all the people that you thought that were important, you went to see them and found out that they weren't really worth seeing. They weren't really that important in terms of, you know, maybe they're important, but they weren't really that interesting of people. They just somehow had some accumulation of material objects. He got a whole different perspective that there must be another side of life, a higher purpose to life. And when he met Prabhupada, then he started to take up Krishna consciousness in a very serious way. So many people are trying to search what is real purpose. Is it just accumulation of material things? I mean, who has more material gizmos and gadgets and things than Americans? Of course, the Japanese are beating the Americans now. They're creating better gadgets and they're accumulating more. But the point is, in that sense, it's just emptiness. It's like the analogy is that if you have a bird in a cage and you fill the cage with, you know, refrigerator, little fan, you know, even give him a little video game, anything you want, right? But you don't feed the bird. And what's the use? So it's like, where's the food for the soul? This is all food for just the external senses, but doesn't actually, the real hankering of the soul, the real spiritual desire of humanity is left unfulfilled.
See, that's what our society, in years previous, they were not necessarily Christian conscious. However, they had a spiritual...
They were more God conscious.
...backbone to them. They had a role, so to speak, where the majority of people had in mind and they agreed upon a certain spiritual concept. But we've lost that, I think, and I think that's basically why our society is in this condition.
If you read quotes by, you know, Thomas Jefferson and other founding fathers of America, there are many very God-conscious quotes. You know, in God we trust. You know, we stand one nation undivided under God. They're very God-conscious. There's no other nation in the world I know of that has "In God We Trust" printed on their money.
To me, it seems as though.
But now it's just like a cliche.
But it's only printed there.
But it wasn't that consciousness in the beginning. There was obviously, maybe there was, you know, still some material, you know, definitely it wasn't that they had the perfect concept. At least they had some good idea. They had a little God consciousness was there. But in the royal road to success, you know, they achieved the success, but like they threw out the baby with the bathwater. Along with it, they threw out whatever little God consciousness they had, and now all that's left is some religion, you know, some social, you know, religion also like is a kind of almost like a ritual, just pray to God that give us our daily bread, not really in the sense of developing a relationship to, in one sense. Or even if they want to develop a relationship, how can you? In the Bible, it's very difficult. Because there's no real information given about God. Very little. If I wanted to become friends with you, I'll either come and sit with you and discuss with you, and we'll do something together, or I'll talk with your friends about you, and somehow we'll get to know each other. Well, when it's like someone who's, say, the President of the United States or some big movie star, then you may not be able to just associate. They're too great for that. They're too important or too elite. So then you may read about them or hear about them. And then gradually you may become attracted by some of their qualities. So in the Vedic literatures, they have just book after book about the pastimes of Krishna, the qualities of Krishna, the devotees of Krishna. The most wonderful thing are the devotees of Krishna. It's just like the example was given, when you see the sky, it may not be so beautiful ordinarily, but when the moon's there, then it's very beautiful. So the Krishna and his devotees together, that combination is the most beautiful. You never see Krishna alone. He's always with his devotees. Either the cows, or his friends, or some, his parents, or whatever. There are always some devotees there. So Krishna, with his devotees, and the quality of their courage, their determination, their generosity, their purity, their selflessness, their love. Reading about that, it's so inspiring. So that we have a little bit in the Bible, some of the devotees of God, and that's very inspiring. But then, if you want to go a little further and actually know something about God, when it came really to the time when Jesus could tell some more, he said that, I have so much more to tell you about the kingdom of my Father, but you don't even know, you can't even understand the things that I'm telling you about this world. What can I tell you about the next world? So it just like cut off then. It didn't go on. It was like it's the bridge version. So now it's the modern day. Now you can try to fly from here to Singapore in about 11 hours by Concorde jet. You see. At the same time, although we can exchange views on every subject, you can exchange views in science, in art, in news, in any subject, but if you want to exchange views on spiritual matters, that's taboo. I'm a Christian, I'm a Jew, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Hindu, or whatever. They don't want to discuss. Of course the Hindus discuss, but they just, you know, hold up a barrier. And then it's time that people understand that there's only one supreme truth, one spiritual truth, one spiritual reality, and different people have their different viewpoints on it. They're not talking about, it's not that anybody has a monopoly on truth.
Right.
It's just that different people have a different, you know, amount of information. Is this for everybody?
I just feel there's more, but you have to take first. It's confident.
It's not offered to the media. Let's put it like this. Pretty light.
Master, I'd like to ask you, did you study directly on the Prabhupada?
Oh yes, I was. He's also his personal servant, secretary, worked under him.
So when did you meet, when did you first meet Prabhupada?
1968.
How long had he been here at that time?
2 years.
He'd been 2 years before that, right?
The first year he only July 1967, he formally registered the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. His first disciple is Mukunda Das. He's my sannyasi disciple. Mukunda Das Goswami. He's the first person also to preach in England. Mukunda Das Goswami. When I joined the movement, there were three temples. One in New York, one in San Francisco, and one in Montreal. I joined in San Francisco at the Ratha Yatra Festival. And when I heard that Prabhupada was, I was going to go to India, but I heard Prabhupada was in Montreal, so I flew to Montreal. And then when I reached Montreal, he just told me to stay there. He saw me in the audience, and he said, "Who is that?" And someone introduced that who I was. This came from San Francisco. He said, "Bring him to my house tomorrow. He can take lunch with me." He sat me down, and he was seeing that I was, there was two other people also came in, one president from San Francisco, Gagamuni, and Brahmananda from New York. And they're very big, and I was that time very thin. And they were, I was between them, and Prabhupada just made us take more and more prasad. And they had a tremendous capacity, but I did not have the capacity at that time. And I was very fortunate because that day Prabhupada smelled a rose and said, I love roses, that when I smell a rose offered to Krishna, it extends to my longevity. It improves my health. So then, I personally would go every day to the florist and get a rose and bring it to Srila Prabhupada and give it to him and do other little services like that, cleaning his room and washing his clothes. Right in the very beginning, he had a lot of opportunity. He was in Canada for 5 months because his American visa had expired and he was waiting for an American visa. So while he was waiting, then I had that opportunity to do a little service. When he left, then he made me the president of the Montreal Temple. Then I went and opened up the Toronto Temple. And from there, he sent me to India. And since 1970, I've been in India.
You just returned from that time coming to India?
And I didn't leave India till 1979. I was in India 9 years at one stretch. You brought special chutneys.
Yeah, this is the
achar, it's a pickled.
Bitter melon.
And this is the
strong.
This is lemon.
Kept in the fridge or just in
no, just outside.
Just in the cabinet, yeah. So then Prabhupada, he came after I was in India 2 months and he came here in 1970. He sent a telegram and asked me to get him a place that he could stay. He wanted to go out to Mayapur. He wanted to get a place at Lord Chaitanya's birthplace and build a big international center there. And so since that time, Prabhupada would spend about, well, up to 74, maybe 4 months a year in India. And after that, 75, 76, about 6 months in India, a year. And he would spend 3 months in Mayapur, where I was, generally speaking, at least 3 months. And outside of Mayapur, I'd usually spend 1 month with him. So we were together 4 months a year, which was... Anywhere else Prabhupada would be traveling, he'd only stay a week or two, but he would stay 2 months at one time. He was building it with all the books that were distributed over the whole world. 10% of the money from the books would be sent to India to build up these big temples for the whole world. So he was directing me what to do in those regards. And directing how to preach, how to establish deities, how to do schools. He was personally teaching us.
Prior to...
Because also, how to deal with the Indians, we didn't have any experience being Westerners. Indians have a different mentality. So he took us through those tender, you know, initial periods of learning how to deal with the people. I mean, how to... You know, not to communicate and how to work with them in a proper mode.
Before you had joined the temple in San Francisco, was it?
Yes, for about 10 days.
You were there for 10 days. What was your life prior to that, if you don't mind?
I was actually going to Brown University, and I was there for the summer. Then I decided to go to find some kind of a spiritual master, but I went around America and saw the contemporary spiritual master, didn't find anybody really worthy of the name.
You found the breakdown we were speaking of earlier, the breakdown in the spiritual background of America.
I had been practicing meditation, different things. I had practiced Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism and different things like that. And then even we was reading Jewish script, all kind of scriptures and books and spiritual books, but then I came to the conclusion that just reading a book and experimenting was about as useful as, you know, just shouting out in the dark or something. But I wanted someone who had already was in touch with the truth and could actually guide and give instruction, who had already gone through the path and could actually give advice. So when I was going to the people who wrote different books, figuring that they were the people that would know. So then the people I met, they just weren't very convincing at all. Rather, they were very convincing the other way. They didn't really practice what they were writing, or didn't really know even as much as what they wrote in practical terms. When I met first the devotees of Srila Prabhupada, I could immediately sense that there was something, a lot more spiritual potency. That is, you know, like a vibration, or they had a special mood about them. And after I met Prabhupada, then I had to come to the conclusion that if I'm going to understand Krishna consciousness, it wouldn't be possible to do that half-heartedly. I mean, I could stay around and kind of observe everything and practice a little bit, but I'd only be able to, so to speak, scratch the surface. But to get into it, if I did it wholeheartedly for even, say, 2 months, I should be able to understand, you know, whether this is the real thing or not. Well, once I reach the limit, then I say, well, I can go on and give it up and do something else if necessary. But unless I actually get into it, I won't really understand what it's all about.
So you got right in, just jumped right into the whole thing.
I jumped quite quickly into the whole thing, and I jumped in to do it wholeheartedly, but in my own mind, in a non-committal way. It's more as an experiment. If I want to really check it out, I'm going to have to just do it, and then. So then, I never stopped. I never found the end.
Have you started any building activity in Mayapur yet? For this big Vedic culture center?
Prabhupada Samadhi?
Something or other. The big, Vedic, I mean, it's really what they call Vedic.
We're doing Prabhupada Samadhi first. Can you give me a care brush?
Yes? This is a very basic one. What is the explanation for Sika? What is the significance of
Sika? Top of the hair?
The back of the head?
Yeah.
Why do we have words? Why does Shiva believe?
The people who believe in the personality of God, they keep the Sika. And those who are impersonalists, who believe just that ultimate truth is just impersonal light or something, they shave their head all the way.
All the impersonalists do, and the ones who aren't impersonalists, like my Krishna movement, leave that tough.
Right. The Buddhists, they shave their heads completely. They either let the hair just grow and don't shave it, or they shave it all off. But anyone who believes in the personality of God, the personal yogis, they'll keep this tough. There's some other mystical significance, which you won't really understand. But that's the basic thing, is that we work as we're devotees. It's been described by some as a spiritual antenna.
Sometimes you hear this, a Christian can pull you back behind.
Yeah. He can grab you by the hair and pull you back.
It's not totally so.
Why? Just like even in the Bible, they had a time when they said those people that put some kind of mark on their house, then Lent or Halak or something like that.
Mr. Blood is the name on the doorpost.
The angel of death is passing by.
Something like that. So then those people were spared, others were killed. The people that wear the Sika, wear the neck, the Tulsi beads, they're protected from certain type of gross misfortunes delivered by Krishna. Of course, the women don't shave their hair. They wear Tulsi beads. That's especially important to wear Tulsi.
Are they blessed? Are beads blessed by a spiritual master?
These beads don't have to be blessed, but in a time of initiation, then again, new beads are put around the neck. But anyone can wear beads. In India, people are afraid to wear Tulsi beads unless they're vegetarian. They don't like to wear Tulsi.
No.
Why would they not like to wear beads?
I don't know the details. Prabhupada never explained. I just know.
It's not offensive. And you cannot trust the Tulsi plant here, of course, people don't observe, but in India, you don't pluck the leaves. You know, at any time you pluck the leaves,
from the tree or from the plant at a certain time. You have to be bathed, you know, properly dressed. You can't just go unclean and touch the plant. So really, you eat unclean food or unclean habits, then you're offending the plant.
You stay away from it.
So it's really better not to people who are
really mainly a superstition has developed. In terms of not wearing tulsi because they're not, I think they're more afraid that if they wear tulsi, they may gradually stop doing all those things because of the effect.
So in other words, if they were unclean, they should not wear the
beads. No, rather they should become clean. It's the backwards logic.
Reverse psychology. Reverse logic.
Reverse psychology.
Finally, you're not fit to be, like, to do anything, you have to be first to make yourself worthy. Mm-hmm. Well, you put to TV, people think that he is a very pious man. You know, so if he hears and people think he's very biased, man, then if he does anything wrong, then they will say, puts the Tulsi feed and does this kind of activity. So that's actually bad for them, because then they cannot do them anything. They have to give up one or the other.
What are your good material and your beads?
Tulsi.
And yours
I told you, Tulsi beads. Yeah.
Okay, yours too, huh? Like the plants they keep in the greenhouse, those are smaller plants, I imagine, than some of the ones over in India and wherever else.
Some are so, this big around.
The trunks of them, huh? Well, it makes you think, they don't have
12 feet high.
Oh, they do get 12 feet high, okay. Is that
the
highest one?
They don't get killed here.
It's pure devotee and make it into an ornament like that.
Now, you don't kill the tulsi plant, only after the plant is no longer living.
Is it naturally expired?
No. Then you take it and use it as a decoration.
Oh, when it's
naturally. Oh, how you say the highest kind of step?
I wondered if you could genie or mystic power to get a stolen car back that was stolen from me out here about 3 days ago.
You know, as a sannyasi, someone who's renounced the material world, you don't get involved in those kind of material things. I think what Krishna is doing by this is he's showing you that the material world is temporary and that everything is possible to be lost in the material world except for Krishna. If you just capture Krishna in your heart, then you never have to worry about losing him. But cars, Seiko watches, Walkman, Sony.
You need to hire yourself.